This is the podcast for Wednesday, October 19th, 2011.
Ethics.
So would the extension be ethical legalism?
No, because an action can't be a viewpoint. So ethical egoism is a viewpoint about all actions, what makes all actions right or wrong. Ethical egoism would say that having a granting extensions would only be right if it was in my interest to do so. So the question is it in my interest to grant extensions? Or is it in my interest to say, absolutely, everyone must take the test by this deadline, otherwise you get an F on the course, or F on the exam, right? So would that be in my interest? So what do you think? I mean, some instructors are like, I don't think it'd be in my interest because, like, first, you know, you have students with legitimate excuses, and then you know something happens, like, you know, their parent dies, or their baby is in the hospital, or I guess something else, you know, they have a psychotic breakdown, there's all sorts of things that happen to people that are really serious. And so I think those people want to give extensions. And then there's like people who are like lazy and, you know, they can't take the test because they screwed around all weekend, you know, watching the Twilight Zone marathon and smoking dope and hanging out with their friends, drinking beer and watching sports or whatever, you know, they're doing, and they weren't when they could have been studying for their exam. So then the question is it in my interest to try to distinguish which people are people who generally should have an extension and those who don't deserve it? And that sounds like a lot of work to me. So I just grant a blanket extension to people and say, can I have an extension? Yes, how long do you need? And then I get a commitment and then I follow up. And that's easier than sort of having an absolute deadline and then trying to ferret out, you know, who deserves an extension and who doesn't. And actually, coming back to the general idea of, you know, what is an ethical theory? So an ethical theory is a theory which explains all ethical actions and categorizes them into right actions and wrong actions. And it gives you a principle that tells you that if you adhere to this theory, here's a guideline for helping you make these decisions. And so it's like, an action is not an egoist action or utilitarian action. Like if I picked up a dinosaur bone, I said, is this an evolution bone or is this a creationism bone? Right? The bone isn't a theory, right? A bone is like a piece of data. And and then you have two theories which might say different things about how old that dinosaur bone is, where it came from, and so on and so forth. Why it's, you know, in the certain fossil strata. The same thing with, to give another example of two competing theories. Okay, well, like, you don't say, was that a behavior? You wouldn't say, was that a behaviorist action or a Freudian action when I married a woman just like my mother, right? Well, it's not, some people might look at that and say, well, that's a Freudian action. But it's not, it's just an action. You have two different theories, behaviorism and Freudianism or the psychoanalytic theory would have different interpretations of that action and different explanations as to why I married a woman just like my mother. And the behaviors would say, well, you know, when you were young, you're stimulated in certain ways and you respond in certain ways and you were habituated to interacting with women in certain ways and that carried over into your relationship with other women. And where you behave in habitual ways and you come to seek out certain kinds of relationships. Why? Because you've been habituated to them through essentially stimulus response training. And the Freudian would say, well, you have this unconscious, you know, desire to marry your mother. And it's somehow related to toilet training and screwed up ideas about sex or something. And by the end, and you want to kill your father subconsciously too, and all this other wacky stuff that Freud said. But you have two different explanations as to why you married someone just like your mother. Those are two different theories, which would have different ways of explaining that. In the same way, morality gives you two different ways of looking at moral action and telling you which actions are right and which actions are wrong and why. So the actions themselves aren't a particular kind of action, but the theories tell you, oh, this action is right because it's, you know, it produces the most happiness. Or this action was wrong because it violated somebody's rights. And that would be like basically like the utilitarian view or the Kantian view. Or the deontological view, which we'll get to after we deal with the egoism and social contract theory. Of the theories like we've looked at, like divine command theory would say that actions is wrong because it violates the laws of God. So, for example, like suppose you have the sort of Christian version of divine command theory, and you have a person who's in a same-sex relationship, and you know, same-sex romantic sexual relationship, and so divine command theory, you know, the Judeo-Christian version would say, well, God commands against homosexuality in both the Old and New Testament. Therefore, what you're doing is morally wrong. Whereas a utilitarian might come along and say, well, morality is all about the greatest happiness for the greatest number, and you know, these two people seem to be happy, they have a fulfilling relationship, and so that's what's important. And so since this is a happy, fulfilling relationship, therefore it's morally okay or it's morally good. So you might get, you might get a utilitarian that might have a contrary judgment, right? He might say, well, this relation, you know, you might get someone make the argument that same-sex relationships are dysfunctional for various reasons and try to give you an argument against them because they produce unhappiness. And so, if you look at particularly male homosexuals, they tend to have a higher rate of suicide, more psychological trouble, and more conflict in their lives, and relationships tend to be shorter lived. A person might put all that data together and make an argument against same-sex relationships for that reason. So different that you could get the same theory might give you different results depending on how it interprets the data, right? So the question is like, what makes people happy? And that might depend largely on empirical data, right? Maybe you'd have to do a bunch of psychological studies on same-sex relationships. And you might get people make different judgments about that, even though they agree that the way you tell whether something's right or wrong is utilitarianism. So each of these theories will give you though a different approach to morality, but there's always this empirical component, and we'll talk about this when we get to political philosophy at the end. And this even came up. This comes up really with Ayn Rand too, I think. But it's that. When you're making a moral judgment, there's always this question about what like the empirical data is. So you have your moral principle, which might be this is still on topic. So you have like a moral principle. Moral principle. So say you have a utilitarianism. And this is a special problem with utilitarianism, I think. So utilitarianism says that it's the greatest happiness principle. That an act is right when it produces happiness, it's wrong if it produces unhappiness. And your moral duty is to create the most happiness possible, not just for yourself, but for the whole wide world, for the general populace of the community, to bring as much happiness as possible into the world. Creates happiness principle. But then the question is, how do you apply this? And you come up with this question about what makes people happy, and different things seem to make different people happy. And there's a whole new field now called happiness studies, which tries to figure out what makes people happy. Is it having, you know, stability, safety, and security, or is it having freedom? And you can see stability, safety, security,
or you might have other things like excitement, freedom. And you can see how these are contrary goals, right? So lots of things you can do that are exciting, but they're also kind of dangerous, right? Think about gambling, for example. A lot of people love to gamble; they find it very exciting. But you know, you could lose your shirt, right? So you know, there's a certain amount of security that comes out of the system if people are allowed to go to the Three Rivers Casino with their paycheck or their life savings and gamble all of the money away. But a lot of people would say, well, that's my money. I should be able to do whatever I want. If I want to, or say, I want to like pay a woman to have sex with me because I go to the bars and I can't get what I want, right? So, or maybe they all say no. And so I was like, but I have all this money burning a hole in my pocket. And I'd like to go out there and have, you know, pay a really hot woman to have sex with me. That's all about freedom, right? My money, my body, my choice. But a lot of people would say, if you let people do that, you're going to spread around a bunch of disease, and there's going to be, you know, women soliciting on the street corners, and nobody's going to like that. And it takes some stability and safety and security out of the world. You have the more disease going around, and it sort of makes things less stable. So the question of what values you have in the society is going to be based on which of these values you think are more important. Is it, and really I think it comes down to sort of this idea of freedom or control. Is a society which control, and with control comes this idea of a certain amount of comfort and I'll put maybe one more thing here, equality. And these are basically like the kind of liberal view, and this is the more kind of conservative or maybe libertarian view, because a lot of the conservatives, they want certain kinds of controls. Libertarian. I'm going to use conservative sort of in the sort of classical sense that conservatives by and large think you're your own person, you run your life. The government can't tell you how much you can make, what you can do, whether you can smoke a cigarette, whether you can drive an SUV. Whether you can eat trans fat, right? They'll say all that stuff is the government has no business in running your life. But then some conservatives will say, yeah, but we should have, you know, maybe there's sort of some kind of nominal support for religion because it's good for people, and maybe they might have to be in favor of like not in favor of legalizing prostitution. Sometimes they come down to gambling too. So it's, but I'm just good. If you think about this as sort of being pro freedom view, and I'll maybe stick with the libertarian view. And this is the kind of the liberal view. They mostly want to control you, but there's maybe a few things like the liberals tend to say. Yeah, but you should be able to marry who you want, and you should have the state should sign off on your same-sex relationship, if they're going to sign off on anybody's relationship. Why? Because equality is really important. And so if you're going to have equality as an important value, you have to have, let gay people marry as well as straight people. But really, the liberals are really all about control. Control the economy, control your private behavior for the common good. And maybe another thing here, the common good. And this is really what Ayn Rand calls collectivism. This idea that everything's about the common good. You only have rights insofar as you benefit the community. And if we all give up a little bit of freedom, if we all eat our peas and sacrifice for each other, we'll live in a utopia. And everybody will have plenty of money. And what do you do if like somebody doesn't have enough money? Well, you just take from Peter, you rob from Peter, and you give it to Paul, and then everything will be great. I had a friend of mine on the Facebook there was saying, what was it, that high taxes are good and it leads to lots of employment. So you like tax those greedy rich bastards enough, and you get like lots of people have jobs because the government creates jobs. And for him, it's all about
control and taking away from people who are greedy and selfish and have too much and giving it with, to people who deserve it, according to this central authority, that don't have enough. The individualist view is the idea that you're a person with rights and you should be as free as possible you should be as free as possible. And what does that mean? Well, it means a certain amount of control of people's baser impulses. So you need the police and the army. You need the police to keep people from violating the rights of others and preventing them from living their lives as they would like to. And you have a place to arbitrate disputes so there aren't, you know, gunfights in the middle of the street and people don't get, you know, if you're killed by a stray bullet, where does your freedom go then? Right? So you need a certain amount of law and order and stability, but only, you know, enough to keep people from killing each other.
And other than that, you should be able to do what you want. And you should be able to have as exciting or as boring a life as you want. And under this system, note that people can, you know, they can live their life in a kind of a boring way. It's not like if you have the freedom to gamble your money away and eat whatever you want and pay prostitutes for sex and shoot cocaine in your veins, that you have to. It's like nobody's forcing that needle into your veins. It's just like you can if you want. So whereas in this system, you can't drive an SUV, you can't eat trans fat, you can't. So it's all about what you can't do. Why? Because everything has to be fair and equal, and everybody has to be taken care of. You can only earn a certain amount of money. Why? Because we want to take some of that money and give it to some other people who we think deserves it more than you do, even though you've earned it. And so these philosophies are different. They're different approaches to which values are the most important. So here, even as a utilitarian, I think you can go either way. Now, the utilitarians, I think, tend to go sort of in this direction because they're thinking about the greatest happiness for the group. But as a utilitarian, you might come over to this direction. Can you think of, like, how would you, as a utilitarian, could you argue for a kind of a libertarian political system? How might you do that? Like, if you're utilitarian, so you're thinking it's not that morality demands that you respect individual rights you think that these values are more important. You think so? Yeah.
Well, would it be just a matter of saying, and let everybody choose what freedom is to them? Is that how they could move to this side of the board, by saying, let every, not just the greatest good for the greatest, I mean the greatest happiness for the greatest good, but just the greatest happiness, and let everybody decide for themselves what the greatest happiness is? And isn't that what Rand was saying?
Yeah, that is what Rand was saying, but I think there's a difference here in that if you're, and I started out with this idea of utilitarianism, and then the question is the greatest happiness principle, which is singular. But then the question is, how do you apply this? And which is the question of what makes people happy? And what makes people happy? Well, you might say what makes people happy is freedom. That people are the most happy in a free society, overall. And so you might say, this might sound good, but you think about, you know, equality is kind of a big cross to bear if everybody has to be equal. There's a great story by Kurt Vonnegut called Harrison Bergeron. It was made into a movie with, I think, Matthew Broderick. Actually, there was a really early PBS version that was made into a bigger movie, like a theatrical release, but with somebody else. I just remember there's an image of, like, they have, like, you go to a ballet and the ballet dancers have, like, lead weights attached to their ankles so that it can't jump higher than the one that can't jump that high, right? You think about if you follow equality to its logical extreme, you basically have to hobble all the people with lots of potential talent and success. And so, you know, inequality is a natural consequence of freedom, but most people really like to be free, and they'll put up with maybe some inequities or problems or have to fall off from their own actions if they get that freedom. So the
way you might do this as a utilitarian, you might say, I believe in the greatest happiness for the greatest number, and what will do that? Well, a free society. Because free market capitalism gives you iPads and iPhones and air conditioning and plentiful food supply and all these great stuff.
What does collectivism give you? Well, the Soviet Union, Cuba, it gives you bread lines, despots, secret police, and people telling you what to do all the time. I'm sorry, what's that?
Wooden cars,
yeah. So you would say the greatest happiest principle is your moral principle, but then how do you apply that? Well, maybe the way to create the greatest happiness is by giving people individual rights. And a lot of what John Stuart Mill says is, I think, supports that. Mill was kind of a classical liberal, or what today we would call a conservative in a lot of ways. He wrote this book called On Liberty, and so really, John Stuart Mill's by political philosophy is libertarian. And so he says, it might seem that we can create the greatest happiness for the greatest number by controlling what you can say. But he says, if you think about how this would work out in the real world, it would lead to a worse state of affairs if the government was censoring people. And so what you need to do is let people say what they want, and then if one person says something you object to, you can, the answer to that is for you to object to it. And so the solution for bad speech is better speech. So even though Mill is the father of utilitarianism, he still believes in a libertarian political philosophy as a way of producing the greatest happiness. Now, a lot of these people that work in happiness studies say that we should all be like the Swedes or the Swiss and have this kind of socialist system, one of these places, the Netherlands, are supposed to be the happiest places on earth. It might just be those people have lower expectations, though, right? If you spend your life walking around in wooden shoes, maybe you know what it feels like to wear some nice, say, a genuine imitation leather sandals or something. Anyway, so now on Rand, Rand would make this distinction pretty sharp. So let's get rid of these utilitarianism thing for a second here. So just think about like this idea of freedom or individualism and versus collectivism. She thinks that's like the real moral battle is whether you as an individual have rights, whether you're your own person, or whether there's going to be some authority which will run your life for you, and whether you have a right to exist apart from society. Like the alternative view, the collectivist view, is that you only have value insofar as you're part of the group, and that you have to justify your existence by
this phrase. Giving back.
Anybody ever hear this? This phrase about giving back, giving back to society. So what does this mean? I've taken this photo class, and we have to do this community service project as part of this class. I'm supposed to be learning how to take pictures, but the instructor has a different vision for the class. And her vision is that you need to give back to society. You need to do something meaningful and socially conscious, and like hook up with a local charity or a community group and give back. So what does that imply?
It implies you took something.
Yeah, you took something, right? That you owe society. You took something, and that you owe a debt to society for all the great things it's done for you. And so you as an individual have to sacrifice, right, to pay back society for all the good things it gave you.
This implies a theft or a debt or something that you got that you didn't earn.
And this is what Rand's really arguing against. She says, okay, you might say, well, it's good of you to give, and to give to people who are sort of down and out and in distress. And, she says, you know, if somebody is in dire need of help and you can help them with a little sacrifice yourself, it would be good for you to do it, but it's not like you're required to do it. And the idea that you're required to spend significant amounts of your time and energy helping strangers, she thinks, it sets the stage for despotism, and it's morally, she said, it's morally repugnant because it says that you don't deserve happiness, and you don't deserve to live free as an individual, but your right to exist depends on your doing things for other people. That you don't have any inherent worth is a sort of message here. That you only derive your worth by helping other people, which is kind of a paradox, right? If I only derive my worth from helping other people, well, what about those other people? Where do they derive their worth from? They're deserving my help. Well, I guess they get their worth from helping everybody else, right? So you get this weird idea where nobody has any self-worth in themselves, but they derive their worth from helping other worthless people. So you get this kind of conundrum, incoherent view that no individual has inherent worth, but somehow we all derive our worth from all the things we do for people other than ourselves. And so that's Rand's view in a nutshell. That's why she says it equates egoism with individualism, the ego, the self-interest. There's a scene in Atlas Shrugged where Hank Reardon is has this new metal he's created. And of course he calls it, typical to Rand, Reardon metal, right? He sticks his name on it. And his company's called Reardon Steel. He's not a humble man. And one of his friends says, Hank, you have to be careful. People might think that the only reason you're in business is to make money. And he says, well, the only reason I am in business is to make money. And the guy says, yeah, but you shouldn't say it. So it's this idea that you should be sort of guilty about doing something that makes you happy. You should spend all your time trying to make other people happy. But if you're doing something for your own pleasure or your own satisfaction, that's somehow morally suspect. And that's the kind of collectivist view. And so you get both, Rand would say, you get basically fascism and socialism are flip sides of the same coin. The fascists want everything to be about the fatherland and patriotism and the military, and they want a collusion between government and business where you have a corporate state, and the corporations and the state both control you and work hand in glove. And today we call that public-private partnership, right? But it's this idea of state control capitalism. State capitalism. I'll put capitalism in quotes because it's not really capitalism, but it's this idea of, or corporatism is probably a better word for it. And then socialism is just a different take on this, except for here the corporations are nominally separate from the state, but really they're just an extension of the state. In socialism, the people, meaning the government, owns the means of production, and so it's basically the same thing under a different name. So the people, I'll just put the government, controls the economy, let's put this, or production, means of production. I'll just put production. Now, remember there's this place where Mike Wallace says, but we live in a democratic society. People voted for this system, right? Whether you're going to call it fascism or socialism or a mixed economy, we have this mixed economy where the state controls the economy in all kinds of ways. Not as much maybe as France, and definitely not as much as Cuba, but the state controls the economy. But, we all voted for it. What's wrong with that? Anybody remember what Rand had to say about that? Oh, this fetish that we all have for putting little blue marks on pieces of paper and putting them in a box and then having somebody tabulate all of them to decide who gets to write down other things on pieces of paper that other people sign and get written down in a big book someplace in Washington, and then they all become rules that we have to follow. Rand says that she doesn't think that you should vote on everything. That's an absurd system, that I can vote away your rights. What if I say, I think about some absurd law I could pass. What if everyone in Eugene voted that Oregon State jerseys were not allowed, right? And anyone caught wearing an Oregon State jersey would be suspended from Lane Community College for not showing Titan spirit. Right, so that would be an unjust law. And she says that you just can't like vote on everything. People have individual rights. You have the right, you know, to wear what you want, right? And that's a fine jersey. If I knew the name, what's the name of the team for Oregon State?
The Beavers.
Go Beavers, right. I'm a California transplant, so. So this idea you should vote, you know, everybody gets together and said, okay, let's see, who should pay the most tax? I know, the people that the top 1% should pay the most. We think we gotta soak the rich. Well, you know, what kind of vote tally do you think you get for that idea? Well, the 99%. Maybe 98% if you have a few principled poor people, are going to say, yeah, get those rich bastards, right? So it's like basically they're ganging up on the people who are successful, the people who figured out how to make money, the people that produce jobs. And so you get the 99% get together and they vote themselves some wealth of the 1%. Well, how's that any different from some guy in your neighborhood, and he's got like this really nice pool table, right? And everybody in the neighborhood, you know, shows up at his front door and breaks down his front door and takes his you know, sort of mahogany pool table and you know, takes it over to Bill's house, and he turns it into like a neighborhood pool table where anybody can use it, because it's not fair that he's hogging this great pool table. It's the same idea. You know, you might even get together at a neighborhood association, right, and take a vote about whether they should seize Bill's pool table. Well, how's that any different than seizing Bill's money? I mean, it's not. So Rand would say this idea that you should vote on everything, that you can take money from people who are successful. Why? Just because they have it and because you can, because there's more of you than there is of them, is an unjust system. And then she says, if you look at the constitutional system we have, it's one of objective individual rights, property rights, and democracy was seen as a danger to the founding fathers. They regarded democracy as mob rule. They established a constitutional republic with a democratic form of government for electing leaders. But it's cheap. She mentioned this also, this idea of limited with limited powers. And, you know, as government expands, liberty contracts. So to maintain individual rights, the idea is you need to strictly limit the power of government. Don't allow people to vote on everything, but just allow them to vote on sort of, you know, questions, you know, who the leaders are, and the legislature gets to determine certain laws, but in, you know, very, very narrowly defined areas. So this is a good segue to Hobbes. So Thomas Hobbes is also a linguist. And Hobbes established something called social contract theory. So what does social contract theory say? Somebody might give me a definition. What is a social? Yeah.
It's people can agree under a certain set of rules to be governed by certain laws. And if everybody agrees, then it's sort of like kind of the Constitution we have. You know, as long as the laws of the legislature don't violate the Constitution or Bill of Rights, we agree, we'll do that.
Now, is this like a literal contract or a figurative contract?
Figurative. In what happens to.
Yeah, so like there's a literal contract in the book. So that's like a joke that somebody put in there, like a spoof of, I'm making fun of social contract theory. So the idea there's an implied agreement. Now, the government would say, well, it's a legally binding agreement. If you're born on U.S. soil, you have all these responsibilities that accrue to you. And even though all these laws were made by generations past, if your mom popped you out on U.S. soil, suddenly you're under all the laws of the United States. And by just continuing to live in the United States, there's an implied contract between you and the state. So there's an implied contract or agreement. Not by agreement, since contract is so redundant. Implied agreement between an individual and the state. I don't remember signing any social contract. I remember I had to register for Selective Service, otherwise I was threatened with fines, and I was told I could get all these great things from the government if I just, like, as soon as I turned 18 as a legal adult, if I signed up to say, hey, if you ever want to fight a war, I agree to fight in that war if you make me, and then I can get all the benefits everybody else gets. So there's like that. So I guess that's the only thing I can remember signing. But you know, you're just born in the United States and you grew up here. And if you, by staying here, the idea is that you agree to abide by the law of the United States. So what's the trade-off here? Well, Hobbes says, basically, if you think about what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is a state of nature. A state of nature isn't like a state, it's a state of affairs. So the state in here is an actual government. Maybe I should use the word government to avoid that. Sorry. Because the word state can mean like a circumstance or the way things are, or a state can mean a government. Right? Like you've seen, I don't know if you've seen those jerseys that say, you know, a state of confusion or something like that. Right? So there's an implied contract between or agreement between the government and the individual. And the agreement is as follows. You agree to follow all the laws of the land, and then the government will enforce the laws of the land and protect you should someone harm you and in doing so violate those laws. So the alternative to this is a state of nature, which Hobbes would say would be a war of every man against every man. So without government to protect us, there'd be chaos. And you'd have people robbing, looting, pillaging. And you'd have a state of perpetual warfare where you'd wake up every morning and think, okay, well, see, I gotta get some food. Who can I find to, like, knock over the head and take their food, right? And you have someone producing food, and that person producing food probably wouldn't be producing food very long because, like, in order to grow crops, for example, you need to invest a certain amount of labor and you need to, like, plow a field. And even if everybody had their little garden plot, I mean, if, what would happen, like, around harvest time? Well, people come and steal your melons or whatever you're growing, right? And you know, you'd only be able to, you'd have to, like, get the seeds from someplace, I guess. And maybe if you planted the seeds, like, you'd go to sleep and somebody would be out there digging up your seeds for their garden, right? So it would just, you'd never be able to produce anything. It would be like, think about, like, the Rodney King riots, right? So you have, like, people breaking out store windows, taking all the TV sets and stereos and stuff. Pretty soon all the stuff's gone, right? And if that was like a regular course of events, how much longer would there be stereos or automobiles or any of that stuff, right? Pretty soon there would be no problem producing it, and you wouldn't really be able to produce those things. So to have a high state of civilization, you need a certain degree of law and order. A person who's manufacturing or producing something, whether it's food or electronics or whatever it is, needs a certain amount of safety and stability. And if you have rampant robbing, looting, pillaging, and so on, it's not possible. So he says life in a state of nature would be, poor, solitary, solitary, brutish. Spell this right. Poor, solitary, brutish, nasty, and short. So nobody wants to live in, like, you know, some place like Afghanistan, where you have a bunch of warlords. And even the warlords, right? You have, like, the warlord, and he has his tribe, and you have these ethnic groups that kind of work together. Imagine, like, a world of like individuals, and you would never have any friends, you would never have a family, it'd just be all these individuals living alone and then going out and try to take whatever they could to survive. This was even pre-hunter-gatherer, right? Now, was there any like a real state of nature? Well, no, so this is hypothetical. The idea is that human beings have always lived in societies where they've made these voluntary agreements where everybody agrees, okay, here are the rules, I'm not gonna knock people over the head and take your stuff, I'm not going to force people to have sex with me that don't want to. I'm going to tell the truth. And what other rules might there be? I won't beat somebody up for no reason, and I won't kill anybody. And these are sort of the basic rules for civilization. And then they get more elaborate as things, time goes on. And then the next step is, okay, we have to make sure everyone follows the rules. We're going to identify a person who's going to take care of that. And we're going to have, as civilization gets larger, we're going to have a special class of people, the soldier or the policeman, to enforce these rules. And so you have, Hobbes thought that you need a person called the sovereign, which Hobbes preferred monarchy meaning having a king. And he even thought about like democracy, and he thought about having like an oligarchy, which is like ruled by a few people. But he thought, no, monarchy is the way to go, because you need one guy to make the decisions. And he might have underlings and so on, but really, you need a stable form of government. And Hobbes thought that monarchy was the best. Now, it might be that you can look back at Hobbes and say, well, Hobbes got a lot of things right, but this monarchy thing is sort of a product of its time. And there weren't any democracies around at the time that worked really well. They only had historical examples of ancient Greece and Rome. And Hobbes thought that the most important thing for the government is it rules with iron fist, and that people fear the king, they fear the hangman's noose, they fear the dungeon. And that's going to keep them from committing crimes, is fear of punishment. And the king's soldiers. And so he thinks that the monarch has to be a kind of strong man. And then he says, well, if the monarch gets too abusive, he'll just have there'll be a revolt. And then they'll put in a new monarch that isn't so bad. But he thought that you need this strong government and in order to enforce the social contract. So people say, okay, the king is leader over us. The king's soldiers prevent people from abusing each other, and now we can go about our lives in peace. And Hobbes, interestingly enough, I think Hobbes gets a bad rap as being like a total, being a fascist. And, you know, he does have this aspect where he thinks that the monarch should have total control, but he also thinks that the monarch ought to chiefly be concerned with protecting people against crime. So it's not like Hobbes thinks that the king should tell you what you do when you wake up in the morning, when you go to bed at night, and lay out your life for you. He just thinks the king is there to keep your neighbor from killing you, burning your house down, taking your stuff. And so that's the role of government, is this kind of self-protection. But he thinks that, again, there's this implied contract between you and the state. You say, okay, state, I'll follow your laws. And the state says, okay, well, I'll protect you with these laws. And so in order to get protection from laws and not be punished, you have to follow the laws. And if your neighbor like breaks the law against stealing, then he's going to go to jail. If your other neighbor breaks the law against killing, then he's going to be executed. And so this sort of keeps people's baser impulses in mind. So that's like this is the first version of social contract theory. And notice it's all based on egoism. It's based on enlightened self-interest. Now, what's the difference between enlightened self-interest and plain old self-interest? What does it mean for self-interest to be enlightened? Do you have any ideas?
To realize that some self-interest acts may be actually destructive or harmful.
Yeah, like, is it my interest to shoot cocaine because it feels so good, or heroin, right? So I'm going to shoot heroin into my veins. Ooh, what a rush, right? This is great. Give me some more of that stuff. Really? $3,000? Okay, well, you know. And pretty soon, you know, you got the shakes and the Joneses, and you're sweaty, and you're breaking into people's houses to steal stuff that's for your heroin habit. Your girlfriend leaves you, you got all these needle marks up and down your arm, and it's all downhill from there, right? So it might seem like it's in your interest to shoot heroin in your veins, but the long-term consequences are bad. So a lot of enlightened self-interest has to do with what's good for you long-term and sort of overall, all your interests. So it might seem like short-term it's in my interest to steal from someone. But really, it's in my interest to live in a society where stealing is rare and where thieves are punished. And so if I support the law and I turn in people who I see engaged in criminal activity, and if I am honest myself, then I can get ahead more by producing something of value for other people. I can make more as a farmer than as a cut purse. I can make more money as a blacksmith than they can as a highwayman. Right? So I could hang out there by the road, wait for some traveler to come by and come up there with my little flintlock and try to hold them up, right, and get some coins away. But eventually people are going to band together and the king's going to say, hey, take care of these robbers, and pretty soon I'll end up in the end of a hangman's noose. And so it's in my enlightened self-interest. What if I want to take a journey, right? If I want to take a journey, I'm worried about the other robbers taking care of me. So it's in my interest to want to be able to travel freely without worrying about being attacked by robbers. In a lot of second and third world countries, that's the case. Like, you go to some places like Guatemala, beautiful land, gorgeous scenery, perfect weather, and just like biodiversity and all kinds of cool stuff there. But it's like, if you're, even at the airport, you get holed up, like, just like going from the airport to Guatemala City. And there's people with machine guns who are going to take all your consumer electronics and maybe kill you. And so it's, who wants to live in a society like that? I like to live in a society like Cottage Grove, where I can go out at 4 o'clock in the morning and go, jogging without worrying about who's going to mug me. Right, because I got my little iPod right there. I'm jogging along, just like an undeveloped area. I'm not worried about somebody jumping out of the shadows and attacking me because it's a low crime area. Because I got the police do these roving patrols, and so it's nice to have that safety and security to know that I can do what I want. And so what I do is I give up the freedom to rob from other people, to attack other people, to murder other people, to rape, loot, and pillage, and in return I get the safety and security of laws. So what do you think about this as a moral theory, as an extension of egoism? Comments, criticisms, support?
Let's think in on that.
What's the relationship between what's moral and legal in this view? What's moral, and then what's legal. What the law says and what ethics say. That's a trick question. There isn't one. So the moral is the legal, and the legal is the moral. So and this, sometimes this view is called legal positivism, which means that there's nothing really to morality other than like the egoism, right? So it's an egoist theory. So it all comes down to self-interest. And it says it's in everyone's interest for there to be a government and for the government to punish criminals and to keep people's baser impulses in check, to save you from their baser impulses and to save them from their baser impulses. And so even though it might be really tempting to attack a weaker person and take their stuff, it's in your interest not to do so. Why? Because you might be punished. And it's also in your interest for there to be a government there that keeps other people from stealing from you. So it's all about this, again, this implied contract. So you follow the law and don't steal because you don't want to be stolen from. Yeah.
Yeah, no problem with it?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
Sure.
I was talking before class, I'm reading a book about William Dodson. He was the ambassador to Germany in 1933.
William Dodson?
Dodds.
N-N-D-O-D-S. Oh, Dodds, okay.
And he watched as Hitler passed law after law after law. I think everything was legal. And that could be a problem with what's morally legal. That, because that's how it played out in, you know, the worst case.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that seems like it's an obvious objection that you don't know what you're going to get with this monarch, right? He could be trying to think of who's a good king or a good queen. Queen Elizabeth, I guess, was pretty good. I know who was Marcus Aurelius was a pretty good leader of Rome. So you do get good kings and people that really care about the welfare of their subjects. But then you get, you know, people like Caligula, right? Who are just like insane. And how did Caligula get to be emperor? Well, because he inherited it, right? And so Hobbes is thinking about a hereditary monarchy. And so that seems like a really bad way to choose leaders. And it concentrates power in the hands of an egoistic person who has no checks on his behavior because he's sort of above the law. Now, in theory, Hobbes says, well, the monarch should enforce the law, but there's nothing that says that he should if egoism is your only moral theory. It's not like he has any obligation to the welfare of his subjects. He only has an obligation to himself. Now, I suppose if he, like, brings in all the intellectuals and has them killed, and, Pol Pot or Pol Pot was going around killing people with glasses. And, you know, anybody that looks like an intellectual would just be killed. They're counter-revolutionary. Or somebody like, Mao Zedong, who's taken the sort of urban movers and shakers and basically busting them out to the farm, the sticks, and say, okay, you're all going to be farmers now. You know, you have mass starvation. Well, I would guess that the economic welfare of China took a big hit, and that therefore it wasn't as powerful a nation. And so, the king wants to have a powerful nation. So, I mean, kings can do stupid things that aren't in their interest. But there's lots of things that kings can do which are in their interest, which is really bad for their subjects. And so this is like the main objection, the monarch has absolute power. Absolute, not only absolute power, but absolute right and powers. He's not only got like legal authority, he's got moral authority to do whatever he wants. Now, I think Hobbes might sort of, his defense might be, well, if you have like a committee or you have a democracy, it's not going to last very long, it'll end up with a despot anyway. So you're always going to end up with like a power concentrated in the hands of a few or one person. Hobbes, if you go around today, he might say, hey, this constitutional republic thing, it seems like a good idea. I was wrong about monarchy. Monarchy was a disaster. If you were to look at history, and he would say, maybe I should revise my view. The main objection he had to democracy was it was too unstable and unpredictable and didn't last very long. It wasn't strong enough. So maybe he would look at the democratic governments today and say that they might work just fine. Let's see. So that's another objection is just
idea that the moral is illegal.
And, you know, it seems like Hitler is a good example where you have laws which, you know, are seem to be obviously immoral, but they're, you know, they're official laws of Germany, that you had to turn in the Jews, that you know, that you could, you know, there's no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly. All those rights were taken away from taken away by Hitler. And so so just because you have a government doesn't mean you're going to have rights. So you need some way of having, you know, sort of fear of the law, but also maintaining individual liberty, which I think you get in a constitutional republic system, but which Hobbes wasn't able to see, I think, just because of his historical time period. He lived just on the cusp of when you had all sorts of stuff going on. I mean, Hobbes writing in the 16th century, so I think you get John Locke 100 years later, and he basically takes Hobbes' social contract theory and applies it to a constitutional government, and gives us the social contract theory we're basically know about today, which is this idea that the government is there to protect you, protect individual rights and liberties, and in turn you follow the law and don't violate the rights of other people. And then you have a more extreme version from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, where you get more of the sort of collectivist system under social contract theory, that you owe your life to the state, that you have to sacrifice, and you don't really have, you don't have rights in the sense of absolute rights, but they're sort of modified rights at the state's good pleasure or permission. I kind of like Hobbes' version, I think, is a little too strong. Rousseau's version is too strong for different reasons. And John, I'll mention John Locke, has a form of social contract theory, which I think is sort of in a good place. And the Founding Fathers drew on Locke's work. And the Constitution is largely a product of John Locke and some Greco-Roman classical forms of government. But Locke's Second Treatise on Government is pretty much the basis on which the Constitution is founded. Let's see. Any thoughts on the social contract theory spoof in the text? I suppose you might see this as a criticism of social contract theory in general, right? This is on page 116, and this is particular to the U.S. So, whereas I wish to reside in the North American continent, and whereas the United States government controls the area of the continent on which I wish to reside, and whereas tacit or implied, again, implied social contract, do I have a different page here? 61? Oh, sorry, 116. Sorry.
201.
Yeah. Okay. This was a. I think this might have been a practice run. The page numbers are off. So was it 201?
Well, yeah, contract. John's got it, but I don't.
It should say what page says social contract of the thought.
Yeah, 116.
116. Hmm. What's going on here? There or something. So you want 116. Oh, you're missing some pages there.
Yeah, a whole bunch
of them. You see me after class.
Pages are falling out.
Yeah, mine are falling out.
Oh, sorry about that. First time I get a good new publisher. So page 116. So I will surrender a percentage of my property to the government. The actual percentage will be determined by the government and will be subject to change at any time, right? So again, who knows when tax rates will go up and go down. Do I have any say? Well, the amount surrendered may be based on my income, the value of my property, the value of my purchases, or any other criteria the government chooses. What's going to be some of the good support social contract theory say? Like, what would somebody down at the Occupy Wall Street protest say about this or something?
Well, if there's some security, you raise taxes.
Well, I mean, what would they say about this? Like, the idea that...
Lower.
the government gets to decide how much I pay, what I pay on, how it's calculated, how much I pay.
They have too much control, don't they? I mean, your property is being willed to them instead of a family member, or...
Well, I mean, that's what someone that like would write this or like say think this is a hilarious thing. But what would a person that disagree with this might say about this? To aid the government determine the percentage, I will apply for government identification number that I'll use in all my major financial transactions.
Yes. Well, the problem is when you have 51% for wanting stuff, 48% for earning stuff. Problem.
Yeah, it does seem to be a problem. That actually supports what's in here, this idea that it says that the government, but really they would say, well, what is the government? The government is we the people, right? And it's, you know, people voted for this system we have. This is what Mike Wallace said, right? People voted for this. This is what people want. Isn't this, you know, ruled by the people? And so what do the people want? The people want their social security numbers. They want to have a government identification number that they can use to identify themselves in all their major transactions. And they want to be able to use that number as a basis of which to get a retirement income funded by the government, right? You want to make sure that if you don't save enough money or you blow all your money in at the Three Rivers Casino or you end up getting sick, that the government's going to take care of you. You're going to get your Medicare, your Social Security, and you're going to get just enough to live on for the rest of your life. That's right. So, I mean, they wouldn't put it that way. They would say, you deserve to be taken care of in your old age, and you deserve to have your to be taken care of if you have health problems. You're just going to let people die of cancer, if somebody gets cancer. There was this woman who, one of these things on Facebook, who's like holding up a sign, you know, and it says like, I love to cut hair. I work in a hair salon. I've cut hair for 55 years and I like doing it, and the only thing I own is like a car. And I don't mind not making very much money, but when I got breast cancer and I didn't have health insurance, then I was really worried. And I was angry and bitter that I wasn't one of the 1% who doesn't have to worry about their medical bills. And because I chose to cut hair for a living, doesn't mean that I shouldn't be taken care of when I get sick. And so and then she says, but thank God I was poor enough to qualify for Medicare, and now the government's going to pay for my chemotherapy and I might live. And then she says, but it took a long time to qualify for Medicare, and so it's not as good as it would have been if the government just would have paid my doctor bills up front instead of making me go through all this rigmarole. So in her mind, like the fact that she has a job, that she works hard, means that she deserves to be taken care of by society. And if she gets sick, society, you, me, and everyone else, should step in and take care of her. If she takes a job where she can't afford health insurance, it has to be provided for her. And that's the kind of social contract idea thing. You do certain things, you work hard at whatever job, something you like doing, and then society takes care of you. Yeah.
From the protesters, I've heard a lot of them say, well, I want my college paid for. Okay. They want me to pay for it, and you pay for it, and they want for it to be free. And it is bizarre that, I don't know, what Harvard has the biggest thing that they have $25 billion sitting in the bank in their endowments.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they want the government to pay for their college. And so it's a social contract, really, is sort of morphed into a big environment.
Well, a lot of people think that all, you know, the universal education like they have in Europe, except for in Europe, they have to ration education. So basically, in order to get into a really good school, it doesn't matter how much money you have to take these big standardized tests, or you have to know somebody. Now, we get some of that here, right? But basically, if you don't do really good on these tests, you don't get into college. There are some technical schools and so on, but a lot of their higher education is based on testing. And so they ration it that way. A lot of other places, they just like jack up the taxes really, really high, and they have kind of mediocre economy, and they also don't have a bloated military to support, so they have maybe a little more money to throw around, and they provide college education. But a lot of those nations also are like up their eyeballs in debt. You look at Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal, and a lot of these countries had huge welfare states, including university education, and it's expensive. There's actually, by the way, before I forget, there's going to be a debate going on. What's the date? It's going to be in early November. I think the first Tuesday, the second Tuesday of November. I think it's the 8th. I'll get you the exact dates and I'll post them in Moodle. But there'll be a debate on why does college cost so much? And it's being hosted by Students for Liberty, and they're looking for people to participate in the debate. So if you're interested in being part of the debate, or you know someone who is, or you know an organization that would like to supply someone, I think they're going to have 3 or 4 people on a kind of a panel, maybe as many as 5, and they're going to host it here on campus here, and talk about why is education expensive. And one thing that somebody like Rand might say is like, well, it's because it's a government system. And even though there's private involvement, it's heavily subsidized by the government, and that drives up the price of education. And if you had a market system, you might not even have college degrees. There might be a lot fewer philosophy professors. And maybe I'd be out of a job. But I'm guessing that there'd be something I could do, or I could do something similar, or maybe something different and make a lot more money. But it's the reason that the costs go up is because of the sort of government subsidies and that drives up the price. And the fact that the government gives you all these loans, right? And then since the government's providing the loans, they can jack up the cost because more students can afford it, and then it costs more, and then you're saddled with this huge debt after you graduate. Community college has gone up, like I think, when I started here 10 years ago, it was like $37 a credit. So it's more than doubled here. 84. Like 84, 80, yeah.
80.
So it hasn't quite tripled. I expect in a couple of years it will triple. But I think this, you hear this a lot, though, people, as long as I do X, then the government should supply Y to me. And usually what they'll say is, what's my part of the social contract? My part of the social contract is what do I get to do? Do I have to like work hard? So, obey the law. Anything else you gotta do?
Pay your taxes.
Study, I'll pay taxes. Pay my, they say, I paid my taxes, now I deserve some back. Pay your taxes. Or are they my taxes? You always say, pay your taxes. How about pay taxes? It's always pay your taxes. Me and then there's the government. And the government says they're going to provide education. Right, so President Obama is saying anybody that gets a B average in high school, they should have their college paid for or something like that, right? So the idea is you work, you study hard, you deserve a free education from the government. You do X, the government provides Y. And note there's no like economic relationship between the two. It's a matter of moral desert. You do something to work hard in a certain way that the government determines, and the government gives you some sort of benefit as a result, some kind of reward. Sit up with your hands like this, and the government gives you a treat. Right? So it's reward. You do a trick, and the government gives you a reward. You obey the law, and the government protects you. You pay your taxes, and the government gives, pennies, right? You get retirement. You get, health care. You get unemployment, for like 3 years. or more. That's the limit's not up to like 3 years.
They
keep on extending it.
Another 3 years.
The kind of weird thing, you know, from my perspective, the kind of weird thing is like, well, it's the government that's responsible for unemployment being so high in the first place, so maybe they do deserve to give you some kind of a minor subsidy for the way they screwed up the economy. But I mean, you always move to Texas or something, right? But then I suppose you could also say, well, you know, you people voted for the system, so maybe you may deserve some of the pain too. So maybe you don't deserve those unemployment benefits after all. But the basic system here, though, is that you pay your taxes and the government gives you these benefits, and these aren't necessarily proportional, right? In our system, like, certain people pay like the lion's share of the taxes, like the rich people pay most of the taxes, and the bottom 50% doesn't really pay anything. You pay like some payroll taxes, which are to support your retirement. But if you look at income taxes, about 50% of people pay no income taxes. Now, they take money out of your check, but then you usually get about the same amount or more back in the form of a refund. And then, you get all these different credits and so on, right? So there's a lot of people that actually get more money back than they pay in, probably a lot of people in this room. But it's this whole idea that the contract, it's that you do certain things and the government gives you certain things back. And that this system, you know, according to the social contract theory, the system is just and right because it benefits everyone that we have. Everyone is educated, that the society has medical care, that nobody is out dying in the street, that we have the police to take care of crime, we have the fire department to put out fires, keep the neighborhood burning down. So it's the price we pay for living in a civilized society to have a system like that, according to the social contract theorists. Although according to the author of this the social contract here, I think they would say that this, they don't remember signing anything and this is nonsense and it's all about government control. And note that there's no way to, like, you know, basically the government doesn't owe you Social Security. So when Social Security goes bust, they're going to have to do one of three things. They'll have to jack up the retirement age. So you're going to be working for, you know, until you're 70, until you can retire. Or they're going to have to cut the benefits. So you're going to have to make do with even less. Or they're going to have to means test it, which basically means that if you pay the system your whole life in the middle class, you might not get anything. They might make Social Security might only be for poor people, and it's going to turn into a new tax. So maybe as you're working through your 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, you're thinking, oh, this is my retirement system. And then it turns out that, oh, no, you know, people that made a certain amount in their lifetime, they're not going to get any money out of it anymore because there's no money left. Anyway, that's the social contract theory. I suppose you can see my sympathies lie with the author of this satire of the social contract theory. And there have been numerous court cases that basically say that the government really doesn't owe you anything. You can't sue the police for not protecting you. You can't sue the national government for not protecting you against foreign invasion. You can't sue the government for not providing your retirement income. And there's no guarantee that you'll get Social Security. It's just sort of the government's word, and it's not something that they actually owe to you. It's considered to be a tax. So on Monday, we're going to start right in with utilitarianism. Make sure to post to the forums by the deadline. I think I've got all the topics up on Sunday, actually. So the topics should be sitting up there now. And I'll see you guys on Monday, and we'll start in with utilitarianism.